Dr. David B. Magleby is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brigham Young University. Dr. Magleby received his BA from the University of Utah in 1973 and his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 1980. He has taught at the University of California, Santa Cruz and at the University of Virginia. Dr. Magleby has served his department and his profession well. He was chair of the Department of Political Science from 1992 to 1998 and the president of Pi Sigma Alpha, the National Political Science Honor Society, from 1994 to 1996. He was a Fulbright Scholar to Oxford University in 1996. Since his arrival at BYU in 1981, Dr. Magleby has received 6 teaching awards, including the Carl G. Mazur Distinguished Teacher Award. His teaching skills reach beyond this campus. Every election year since 1982, Dr. Magleby has organized and directed the Utah College's exit poll, a statewide poll that involves more than 600 students from 8 Utah colleges and universities. Dr. Magleby is internationally recognized for his scholarship on direct democracy, campaign finance, and voting behavior. His publications include the book Direct Legislation, which is the seminal work on direct democracy in the United States. He is a co-author of 2 other books, The Money Chase and The Myth of the Independent Voter. He has also published numerous articles in political science journals. During the 1998 election cycle, Dr. Magleby directed a group of scholars to monitor 16 of the most competitive U.S. House and Senate races. Funds for that research were provided by a grant from the Pew Charitable Trust Foundation. That research is summarized in a book he edited entitled Outside Money, Soft Money and Issue Advocacy in the 1998 Congressional Elections. This research was so successful that Dr. Magleby was asked by the Pew Foundation to continue the research in the 2000 election cycle in order to study the effects of outside money in both presidential and congressional campaigns. His research efforts have significantly influenced the way countless scholars, policymakers, and students think about the relationship between money, elections, and representative democracy. Dr. Magleby has served as a bishop in a BYU student ward and is currently a priest quorum advisor in his home ward. He is married to Linda Waters, and they have 4 children, Joseph, Katie, Daniel, and Benjamin. It is my pleasure to introduce my dear friend and colleague, Dr. David Magleby.
Thank you, Kelly, for that kind introduction, and thank you, Anna, for that wonderful prayer. As a student of elections and democracy, I study the role that we as citizens play in our constitutional democracy. My objectives today are to share some of my own research on these topics and to make the case for your own civic engagement. Many Americans take democracy and freedom for granted. When we vote on election day, we assume the ballots will be counted fairly, that rules of our electoral system will be impartially administered, and that power will be transferred to a winner on a predetermined schedule after the election. Yet, in the last few weeks in Peru and Yugoslavia, we have been reminded that people in power often attempt to rig elections, that harassment and intimidation can infiltrate the democratic process, and that the timely and peaceful transfer of power is not a given. The Yugoslav people, when given the mechanism of an election, expressed their popular will. When the results of that election were disregarded, they exercise massive civil disobedience and strikes. All of us should remember the risks they took and the palpable desire they felt for a government determined in an election. Next January, as the powers of the U.S. presidency are peacefully transferred to a newly elected president, we should be grateful for this and for the other blessings of our constitutional democracy. Today I want to discuss 4 strengths and some weaknesses of our democratic experiment as we enter the new millennium. First, I will discuss declining rates of participation and turnout. Second, I will talk about the role of political parties. Third, I will discuss the growing importance of money in elections. And finally, I'll talk about direct democracy. Much of what I will talk about today is research I've conducted since joining the faculty at BYU. I want to thank the university for the support it has provided my research, as well as the many undergraduate research assistants who have been so much a part of my work today, and several of whom are seated on the floor. I will also be talking about data that has been gathered by the KBYU Utah College's exit poll, a collaborative effort begun 18 years ago with my friend and colleague Howard Christensen of the BYU Statistics Department. Students in the Statistics Department, and hopefully some of you are here today, will design the sample for the exit poll and take primary responsibility for data entry. Students from Political Science 317 design the questionnaire, recruit and train the interviewers, and analyze the data on KBYU-TV on election night. The project now involves 9 colleges and universities in the state, with roughly 500 college students interviewing voters on election day, and another 200 statistics and math students who enter data in the Kimball Tower. The process also involves communication students who are part of the election night program on KBYU-TV. To those of you who will participate in this year's project, thank you for spending a day in places you may not know how to pronounce, like Tooele, Juab, or Duchesne. Later in my presentation, I will summarize some research that I'm presently conducting under a grant from the Pew Charitable Trusts on the role of non-candidate campaign spending in competitive congressional and presidential elections. I am blessed to have had 4 recent BYU graduates work on this project as research associates over the past year. Let's begin by talking about turnout. Citizens in the United States have the opportunity to vote more often and for a wider array of officials than do the citizens of any other democracy. Voters typically not only vote for the governor of their state, but for other statewide offices like attorney general, treasurer, and auditor. In addition, different states ask voters to cast ballots for offices like insurance commissioner, superintendent of public instruction, university regent, or state Supreme Court. Our penchant for democracy expanded near the turn of the last century with the Progressive Movement, which enacted the primary elections in which voters, rather than party elites, determine which candidates may run for office. General elections then decide who will hold office. Primaries are a distinctly American invention and roughly doubled the number of elections we have. While the sheer frequency of elections in our democracy may be part of the explanation for low rates of participation in some elections, that is no excuse for not voting this fall. The 2000 general elections have high stakes. With no incumbent in the race for the White House, both parties and their allied groups see this as an election not only for the next 4 years, but to set the stage for the next 8 years. Moreover, a shift in partisan control of both houses of Congress is a distinct possibility. A net shift of 4 seats in the U.S. Senate and 6 in the U.S. House could shift party control from the Republicans to the Democrats. The majority party elects the leaders of the chamber, including the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the Senate, and the majority party controls the committee chairs as well. There's a lot at stake. Finally, in 2000, voters will elect the state legislators, who will redraw the state legislative and U.S. House district boundaries based upon the 2000 census population counts. The demographic and partisan composition of legislative districts is an important political variable for a decade, and not until 2011 and 2012, when the boundaries will be redrawn again, will we have the opportunity we have this year to elect those who draw the boundaries. Some argue that it is irrational for you to vote in elections, that the likelihood of your vote determining the outcome of an election is so small that voting is not worth the investment of time that it takes to register and to vote. I disagree with this argument on several levels. First, there are elections where fewer than one voter per precinct made the difference in who serves in the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate or in many other offices. Your vote can make a difference in who wins and loses. Second, implicit in the voting is irrational argument is the notion that elections do not have consequences. This also is false. A study of American history points out major turning points in 1824, 1860, 1896, and 1932. These turning points reshaped our politics and public policy in fundamental ways. But other elections have done so as well. The election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and the implementation of his tax cuts meant the debate shifted to which programs to keep or scrap rather than which new programs to fund. The landslide election of Lyndon Johnson in 1964 is a second example of an election that had important consequences for public policy for generations. Third, it is not a given that government is good and fair and just. As the people of Belgrade have so dramatically shown us, popular consultation must sometimes be fought for, and we should be very nervous about ever losing it. President Ezra Taft Benson said, and I quote, "As citizens of this republic, we cannot do our duty and be idle spectators," close quote. Finally, I think it only fair to restate the wisdom of a bumper sticker. If you didn't vote, don't complain. Added to these reasons for voting is the Council of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I quote from their letter of 4 October 2000, quote, "We urge church members to study the issues and candidates carefully and prayerfully, and then vote for those they believe will most nearly carry out their ideas of good government. Latter-day Saints are under special obligation to seek out and then uphold leaders who act with integrity and are wise, good, and honest," close quote. Another explanation for voter apathy is that the two parties are so similar that our system presents an echo rather than a choice for voters. To an extent, this is true. Why are the major parties moderate and centrist? Because they reflect the underlying distribution of public opinion. Most voters are more pragmatic than ideological. Often individuals have inconsistent positions on different issue dimensions. It could be argued that the centrist tendency of our politics is more a strength than a weakness because it encourages moderation and compromise over conflict. Having said this, one can learn just by watching the presidential debates that there are real differences between the parties on several dimensions this year. Voter turnout has been declining, and part of the reason for this decline is people your age, 18 to 24. The figure before you plots voter turnout by age in presidential elections since 1964. Note the steady rise in turnout as age increases. An additional explanation for the drop in turnout appears to be the disengagement of voters generally, but part of it is the apathy, especially among the youngest voters. The next slide plots turnout for 18 to 24-year-olds, your age group, and all other voters since 1964. You're the bottom line. Since the right to vote was extended to 18 to 21-year-olds, the proportion of young people voting has dropped, and it hit an all-time low in 1996, with less than 1 in 3 persons in this age group voting. Reversing this trend is important to the sustained vitality of our democracy. The second individual-level characteristic associated with turnout is education. The next slide plots turnout for the same period by categories of education. Note the steady rise in rates of turnout as education increases. Citizens with a bachelor's degree are 20% more likely to vote than those with high school degrees only. Clearly, education increases a citizen's awareness of the world and public affairs, but it also boosts confidence in dealing with bureaucracy, even bureaucracy at BYU. Registering for classes online with Route Y, appealing a $20 parking ticket when you parked in the A lot because you thought it was for A students, or speaking your mind from the soapbox on the quad, may serve to increase your sense of efficacy and help you deal with government as well. You are more likely to complete the forms necessary to vote, to persist in getting public officials to answer your question, to see your opinion as important. Let's shift now to political parties and the role they play in our constitutional democracy, or any other successful democracy for that matter. A noted political scientist once said, quote, "The political parties created democracy, and modern democracy is unthinkable save in terms of the parties," close quote. Another way to think of this is to ask yourself the question, how would I function in a democracy without parties to help structure the process? Some years ago, a community college district in Los Angeles held a nonpartisan election in which any registered voter could run if he or she paid the $50 filing fee and gathered 500 valid signatures on a petition. 133 candidates were on the ballot. Each voter had 5 votes. Political parties were not allowed to nominate candidates, and no party labels were on the ballot to help orient voters. Well, how did people vote in such an election without parties? The candidates were listed alphabetically, and those whose names began with the letters A to F did better than those later in the alphabet. Being well known also helped. Given what we know about personal ambition, do we doubt that there would be 133 or more candidates for most offices if we did not have the political parties to help organize the competition? In addition, parties help unify the electorate, organize government, and provide a loyal opposition. Having said this, it is important to note that political parties are extra-constitutional entities. In other words, the Constitution neither described nor called for the creation of political parties. Given our winner-takes-all election rules, it is also the case that we are most likely to continue to operate with two major parties. And neither party is going to have positions that you or I are comfortable with on all major issues. Because the parties are organized around the units of electoral competition, and because most offices are at the state level, the most important parties are the state parties. Here, there is dramatic variation between states, even within the same national party. As you move from state to state, you will find evidence of this variation. Political parties, including minor parties, are malleable, and they respond to the pressures of interested individuals within them. If you don't feel comfortable within any party, choose one and start to work within it to change it. It is part of our national mythology that Americans vote for the person and not the party. The reality is that more often than not, the person we vote for is from our party. Partisan identification is the subjective sense of affiliation that people have with a political party. It's like a brand label preference in consumer behavior, or what might be called a standing decision. An example of a product most of you have made a standing decision on is toothpaste. Few of you spend much time deliberating on which toothpaste to buy as you do your shopping. You're busy people. You know what you prefer, and you quickly move on to other decisions. You pick up that tube of toothpaste, and you move on. In much the same way, voters have made a brand label preference with partisanship, and they utilize that preference in voting, especially in instances where they have little other information, like contests for county commission or for the state legislature. Partisanship is generally acquired in the family, and it's reinforced by life experience and associations. It's measured by asking the following questions. Answer in your mind as I walk you through the questions. Generally speaking, in politics, do you consider yourself to be a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, or what? Since the early 1950s, all but about 2% to 4% have labeled themselves Democrat, Republican, or Independent. If you answered Republican or Democrat to that question, we would then probe you by asking the following question. Do you consider yourself a strong or a not very strong Republican, or if you said Democrat, Democrat? If you answered Independent to the first question, as about 1 in 3 Americans do, then we would ask, do you consider yourself as leaning towards either the Republican or the Democratic Party? Roughly 2/3 of all independents lean one way or the other, and in about equal numbers towards the Democrats and Republicans. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about the independent voter in the 2000 elections, and in every election since 1974, when the number of independents surpassed Republicans for the first time in the initial party question that I asked. But 2/3 of all independents are really partisans in their voting behavior. Independent leaners, including those of you in this room who said you were, are actually as loyal or more loyal to the party they lean towards than the people who said they were partisan, but not so strong in their partisanship. Unlike the popular stereotype of independents as knowledgeable and impartial, independents without party leanings are more typically out of it politically. They have the lowest levels of political knowledge and the lowest levels of turnout. They do swing back and forth and often seem to side with the winner, but these true independents constitute under 10% of the electorate, not the 30% or so that you're hearing about in the media. The figure you see now gives you the party identification breakdown for voters in the United States in the 1990s. Roughly 90% of Americans express a party preference of one degree or another. The Democrats hold a slight edge in party identification nationally. In Utah, that regularity is reversed, with Republicans having much larger numbers, but the proportions of pure independents is about the same as nationally. In a close election, pure independents matter, but just as important for candidates is winning the vote of the not-so-strong partisans and the independents with partisan leanings. Well, how important is partisan identification to voting? Very. Let me show you some data. Let's look at the data from presidential voting in 1992 and in the 1990s. Over 90% of strong partisans voted for their party's standard bearer in 1992, and they're likely to do again on November 7th this year. Note that the not-so-strong partisans are less loyal to their parties than the independent Democrats and the independent Republicans. Pure independents were the most volatile and the most likely to vote for Perot. As the next table shows you, on average, Utah voters mirror the national data. Independent leaners are really partisan in their voting behavior in Utah, and strong partisans live up to their self-description. But if people only voted their party, Democrats would win all national elections and Republicans all Utah elections. Well, they very nearly do. What explains departures from partisanship? First, candidate appeal, and second, issues. Candidate appeal is the positive or negative view that voters take of candidates. Let me illustrate with some examples. Ronald Reagan was a skilled communicator who conveyed a likable quality. He also understood that to win, he would need to appeal to Democrats and independents. In a speech to the Teamsters Union, he began by saying, and I quote, "Fellow union members, I address you this way with pride, for I carry a lifetime membership card in a union," close quote. Reagan's union was the Screen Actors Guild, hardly blue-collar. Reagan sought to build a common identity, however, with the union members present, even though union members do not generally vote Republican. Reagan worked hard to reach out to what became known as Reagan Democrats by emphasizing his more universal themes of leadership and strength and by downplaying party in the general election. Utah, a highly Republican state, had Democratic governors for 20 consecutive years, with Governors Rampton and Matheson. Both of these successful candidates emphasized their management abilities and their identification with Utah values. The data you see now shows how Democrat Bill Orton won election three times from this congressional district, one of the most Republican districts in the country. He won by getting half of the independents who lean Republican and half of the not-so-strong Republicans to vote for him, and by getting a quarter of the strong Republicans to do the same. So candidates do matter, and voters assess them carefully in the more visible contests. Issues can also be important in the voting calculus. One way voters integrate issues is by making a retrospective judgment about how the incumbent or the party of the incumbent has performed in office. Important in this assessment is the state of the economy. It is not uncommon for us to hear politicians ask voters to ponder, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" Individual voters will be attuned to how the candidates stand on issues of great importance to them, like the environment, or taxes, or Social Security, or abortion. But more typically, they rely on a more general sense of the leadership and the personality of the candidate. Now let's shift to money in politics. It costs money for candidates, parties, and interested individuals and groups to communicate with voters. And with the importance of television as a medium of communication, the costs of campaigns and elections have risen dramatically. The relationship of money to our electoral democracy is a complex problem, one worthy of a semester's study. It involves fundamental constitutional liberties, like freedom of speech and freedom of association. It also involves the legitimacy of the electoral process and public confidence in election outcomes. I would like to highlight three major problems with our current system. One, the unequal distribution of campaign resources that contribute to the lack of competition. Two, the growing importance of interested money. And three, the problem of anonymous issue advocacy. In most of our election contests, the problem is not so much that we spend too much money as it is that challengers are invisible. As we enter the final stretch of this year's race, less than 1 in 10 of the contests for the U.S. House of Representatives have challengers who had enough campaign resources to make it onto the radar screen of the typical voter. Many incumbents may deserve re-election, but they will not be called on to articulate why because of this lack of competition. One reason for the tremendous incumbency advantage in our electoral system is that incumbents have access to more interested money than do challengers. Interested money comes from individuals or groups with a policy agenda and is given with at least the implicit expectation that if elected, the politician will protect those interests. Incumbents are heavily reliant on money from political action committees, or PACs. PACs are not monolithic. They include labor unions, businesses, single-issue groups, and other interest groups. The figure you see now shows the tendency of PACs to give to incumbents and not to challengers. In the 1980s and 1990s, you will note that PACs gave 80% of their money to incumbents. If we were to compare that to others, we would find that 60% of money given by individuals goes to incumbents, and only 40% of the money given by parties goes to incumbents. Very little PAC money goes to challengers. The amount of money in politics has dramatically and drastically increased over the past few election cycles. After the Watergate scandal, Congress passed the Federal Election Campaign Act to limit corruption by limiting the money candidates could raise from certain sources and by limiting the amounts of money that parties and groups could give to candidates. Then in 1979, the Federal Election Commission interpreted the law to permit unlimited donations to be given to political parties as long as they are used for, quote-unquote, party-building purposes, such as generic party mail, party billboards, TV ads about the party, or maybe a bumper sticker. Well, what exactly is soft money anyway? Defining hard money helps to clarify the terms. Hard money, under federal law, is money contributed to a party or a candidate for election purposes. Any contribution over $200 is disclosed, and individuals and interest groups are limited in how much they can give a party or a candidate. For example, an individual cannot give a candidate more than $2,000 in a two-year election cycle, and individuals also have a $25,000 aggregate individual contribution limit to candidates and parties combined. I know that most of you are up against that $25,000 limit already. Because of these limits, candidates are forced to raise money from a lot of people if they hope to raise the roughly $750,000 that they will need to be a visible candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Because of the limitations, hard money is harder to raise. Soft money contributions are disclosed, but they have no limits. Parties now court individuals and groups who can make large soft money contributions. Soft money has the additional strategic advantage of having no limit on how much can be spent in any one race. If the party committee wants to spend millions on a specific Senate race, the committee can do so. This, in fact, happened in the Kentucky Senate race in 1998 when the National Republican Committee spent about $3 million on behalf of the Republican candidate Jim Bunning. This year, soft money expenditures equaling $1 million or more have been made for U.S. House races, including the contest in Salt Lake City's 2nd Congressional District. Soft money spending on this magnitude can effectively double the amount of campaign spending in competitive races. In the 1996 presidential contest, parties used soft money to promote candidates and not just promote the party. And in 1998, a midterm year, the National Congressional Campaign Committees dramatically increased their soft money spending in congressional races. 99% of party ads in 1998 mentioned candidates by name, and these same ads rarely mentioned the name of the party. But who is responsible for the content of these communications? What if a candidate disagrees with the charges in his own party's soft money attack on his opponent, as happened in the 1998 South Carolina U.S. Senate race? Does soft money give too much power to the National Congressional Campaign Committee chairs who make decisions on allocation of these funds in $500,000 and $1 million increments? Although we don't have the time in this setting to pursue this further, these are important questions to contemplate. Another source of outside or non-candidate campaign spending is so-called issue advocacy. In a landmark 1976 decision, Buckley versus Valeo, the Supreme Court said that individuals and groups could not be limited in their independent expenditures for or against candidates. In a footnote in that same decision, the court distinguished between communications that used words like vote for or vote against, which the court defined as express advocacy. Communications that did not expressly say vote for or vote against or similar words like those were defined as issue advocacy and were exempted from expenditure limitations and from disclosure requirements. The issue advocacy exemption from disclosure sat there for nearly 20 years before interest groups in 1994 and then again in 1996 started to exploit it on a large scale. In 1996, organized labor spent over $35 million in issue advocacy against 105 members of Congress, including 32 freshmen. Much of that money was spent on television ads. The business community quickly responded and spent an estimated $5 million defending these same candidates. We say estimated because they're not required to disclose, remember. In the 1998 and 2000 election cycles, I have organized teams of scholars in competitive congressional contests and key presidential primary states to monitor soft money and issue advocacy communications. The scope of our research includes not only broadcast advertising, but also what political consultants call the ground war, which is political mail, phone calls, flyers, internet communications, and the like. After the election in November, and then early in the new year, I will release the results of a series of focus groups, a national web TV survey, and our data collection from 17 general election contests. One of our research questions is to see if citizens like you can distinguish between express and issue advocacy. The distinction is important because in competitive contests, voters will likely see more soft money and more issue advocacy communications than candidate communications. Now, this is not to say that candidates in these competitive races will not be spending on their own behalf. The hard money spending in these same races is generally much higher than in other races. To help you think about the distinction, I'd like to show you some ads that were included in our focus group research on the presidential election that we conducted this month, past month. You may well be the world's largest quasi-focus group. After you watch the ad, I'd like to ask you to answer some of the same questions I asked the participants in our actual study. Let's go to the first ad.
Have you heard about Al Gore's raid on your Social Security check? Every month, the government will take the new Medicare drug premium out of your check. $25 a month in 2002, and later it grows to $51 a month. I've got a message for Al Gore. Get your hands off my Social Security check. It's not enough now. I want no part of Al Gore's Medicare scheme.
Now please answer these questions. What do you believe was the primary objective or purpose of this ad? Select one. To persuade you to vote for a candidate, to raise money, to persuade you to vote against a candidate, to present an issue, to persuade you to get out and vote, to promote a particular political party, something else, you're not sure. Please answer in your own mind. Second, do you remember seeing who paid for this ad? And who did pay for that ad? Now I'd like to show you a second commercial.
George W. Bush says he has a plan for children's health care. But why hasn't he done it in Texas? Texas ranks 49th out of 50 in providing health coverage to kids. It's so bad, a federal judge just ruled Texas must take immediate corrective action. The judge's findings: Bush's administration broke a promise to improve health care for kids. The needs of abused kids are neglected. Texas failed to inform families of health coverage available to a million children. The Bush record, it's becoming an issue.
Now please answer the following question. What do you believe was the primary objective or purpose of this ad? Select one. To persuade you to vote for a candidate, to raise money, to persuade you to vote against a candidate, to present an issue, to persuade you to get out and vote, to promote a particular political party, something else, you're not sure. And did you notice who paid for this ad? Well, let me tell you a little bit about the two commercials you just saw. The "Keep Your Hands Off My Social Security Check" ad was an issue ad and not an express advocacy ad because it did not use any of the express advocacy words. It was paid for by the Republican Leadership Coalition, which is not affiliated with the Republican Party. This group has not been very forthcoming about who contributes to it. Groups like these can hide their donors behind innocuous names like Republican Leadership Coalition. And because they are not engaged in express advocacy, they didn't say vote for or vote against, they're not required to disclose who they are or where their money came from. The second commercial might be called Broken Promises. It was paid for by the Democratic National Committee and was funded largely by soft money. Both parties will set records this year in soft money ads, and many of the ads are aimed at defining the candidates. One recurrent pattern has been the candidates spending their money on more positive ads, leaving to the parties the more negative ads like the one you saw. Finally, let me show you another ad that has been running for the past year.
I see emergencies every day, but this one is getting worse. Congress and the White House cut funding to hospitals to help balance the federal budget. Unfortunately, the cuts went much deeper than they thought.
More than a third of U.S. hospitals are losing money. Many may eliminate vital medical services. Some are even closing.
Now America has a huge budget surplus, but the hospital cuts continue, and it hurts my patients' care.
Tell Washington to restore funding to our hospitals.
Again, please answer this question. What do you believe was the primary objective or purpose of this ad? To persuade you to vote for a candidate? To raise money? To persuade you to vote against a candidate? To present an issue? To persuade you to get out and vote? To promote a particular political party? Something else? You're not sure. I know this is repetitious. Now that you know what to look for, you are more attentive to taglines, the small print at the end of the commercials that say who paid for the ad. This ad was paid for by the Coalition to Protect America's Health Care. I suspect most of you saw this ad as about an issue and not about trying to influence your vote for or against a particular candidate. This we might call a pure issue ad. Why are the issue ads that seek to influence your vote a problem? First, as you saw, voters do not know who is paying for them. Groups invent innocuous names and essentially campaign anonymously. Second, since there is no limitation on how much they can spend in this way, groups can flood a contest with these kinds of ads and reduce the impact of the candidate's hard money communications. In our electoral democracy, voters are used to thinking that candidates are responsible for campaign communications, and hence voters are likely to blame them for issue ads that are too negative or offensive, even though the candidates themselves had nothing to do with their creation. Candidates not only run against one another, but they run against the party of the opponent and the allied interest groups of the opponent. Broadcast ads are only part of the outside money strategy in our country's most competitive contest this year. Groups and parties will be sending mail to voters and using the telephone to contact voters in the final days of this race. Voters may also receive a dozen or more recorded message phone calls, often making extreme statements. The tactic has become so commonplace that candidates themselves sometimes hide their own communications behind what looks like an issue advocacy group. Hopefully, this research will help legislators and judges as they craft campaign finance laws and judicial rulings in the future. The final topic I'd like to discuss today with regards to our democracy is direct democracy, the power given to voters to enact laws themselves. Voters in roughly half the states not only must decide how they will vote in candidate contests, they also vote on ballot initiatives, proposed laws or constitutional amendments placed on the ballot by petition of a substantial number of registered voters. As this map indicates, this process of initiative and popular referendum is a distinctly Western phenomenon. Some states, rather than allowing voters to directly vote on a new law, provide the indirect initiative, which gives the legislature an opportunity to enact the proposal. The more common form of the process is the direct initiative, which permits petitioners to place their proposal directly before the voters. Like the direct primary, the initiative and popular referendum were reforms promoted by the progressive movement. Now, for voters in initiative-prone states like California, Washington, and Oregon, it is not uncommon for them to face as many as 20 or more statewide ballot questions, with one-third or more of those initiatives. This year, for instance, Oregon voters will decide 26 statewide initiatives. As this process has grown in importance, an initiative industry has developed around it. Political consultants facilitate every step of the process, from signature gathering to post-election litigation. Groups that are threatened by an initiative often place counter-initiatives on the ballot. These measures are on the same topic, but often only partially address the concerns of those pushing the issue. In 1988, for instance, California voters had five separate insurance-related initiatives to vote on. The complexity of the language describing the measures on the ballot and the occasional wording where a yes vote means a no outcome can confuse voters. A 1976 California initiative to limit nuclear power development confused many voters because they thought they were voting on nuclear power. A yes vote was actually a vote against development of nuclear power. More generally, voters are skeptical of initiatives, defeating them about twice as often as enacting them. Because the progressive reformers were so distrustful of the institutions of government, checks and balances like a gubernatorial veto or a second house of the legislature that must also approve the legislation are absent. The only check on direct legislation is judicial review. Courts have not been reluctant to rule on the procedural issues of the initiative and referendum, sometimes even removing questions from the ballot. Courts have also been called on to decide the constitutionality of initiatives. As often as not, they have declared successful initiatives unconstitutional in whole or in part. But this puts courts in the awkward position of overturning a vote of the people. Calling upon the courts to oversee this process has politicized the judiciary in California and was a factor in the defeat of three California state Supreme Court justices. I personally favor the imperfect institutions of representative democracy over direct democracy. In the not-too-distant future, we will be pressed again to enlarge the role of voters to include frequent referendums on the Internet or some other electronic process. I think there are important democratic values that come from deliberation, interaction with people of different points of view, and eventually accommodation. Under representative democracy, voters have a responsibility to choose wisely those who will represent them at all levels of government and in that deliberative process. Then in subsequent elections, voters need to hold those officials accountable for their actions. Democracy is messy, often frustrating, and generally incomplete. It is also something upon which reasonable people can disagree. If we all agreed on policy and politics, it would not be necessary to design governments, to protect freedoms, or to conduct elections. Understandably, political differences can evoke strong feelings. At commencement exercises at this university in 1968, President Hugh B. Brown, first counselor in the first presidency, offered some wise counsel. He said, and I quote, "Strive to develop a maturity of mind and emotion and a depth of spirit which will enable you to differ with others on matters of politics without calling into question the integrity of those with whom you differ. Allow within the bounds of your definition of religious orthodoxy a variation in political belief. Do not have the temerity to dogmatize on issues where the Lord has seen fit to be silent." Close quote. The United States is a large and complex country. I believe the political engineers who designed our constitutional democracy understood the need for popular consultation, but also for deliberation and checks on our passions. Over the more than two centuries of our democratic experiment, we have gradually moved in the direction of expanded suffrage and a larger role for voters. What is uncertain in 2000 and beyond is whether we, you and I, will play our role and whether we can adapt our magnificent system to new challenges. The answer to these two questions is up to us. Please vote. Thank you very much.